Hey, all right. Hey, my name is Tyler Lindsay, and I serve at Frontline South as our community group director, so thanks for being with us. Hopefully today feels like the analogy that we brought up quite a bit last year about Vince Lombardi holding up a football to the Green Bay Packers and saying, hey, gentlemen, this is a football. And so I'm aware, even as Chad talked, man, a lot of the stuff that we're trying to sit under is not new. But quite honestly, all of us drift in different seasons. And so I'm tasked with the topic of a missional life. And just even before we jump in, hopefully if things sound new to you, you should come and ask me a question, because hopefully it doesn't sound new. Hopefully it sounds like, hey, this is the paths that Christians have walked for a long period of time. And so we want to come back underneath that burden, and we want to also go first as leaders. If community group leadership is nothing else, it's just being willing to go first. Often you're the first one that shares in discipleship group, or you have to be the first one to exhort someone to pray for someone in a discipleship group, and all of those things. So hopefully today leads us to go first in embodying a missional life. So I want to start our time with A.W. Tozer's words, where he says, "What comes into your mind when you think of God is the most important thing about you? What comes into your imagination? What you think about, what the God that you picture or worship is like, will shape your whole life." And that's true, because you ultimately do become like the God you worship. And so as the Apostle Paul says in 2 Corinthians 3, as we behold who our God is, we're then transformed into his same image, one degree of glory to the next. And this is why, as Chad said, the hospitality of God doesn't just have the potential to change our hospitality. If we'll actually receive his hospitality, it will change how we offer hospitality to others. And that's important to remember, because anytime the topic of a missional life gets brought up, I at first just feel discouragement. And then I find myself saying, like, man, if I had more time to do this, I would be incredibly missional. If I had just read all of the books that, like, Chad reminded me that I should read, I would know all the answers to the questions that my friends far from God would ask. Or, man, if my friends were different, or if the people next to me weren't like the street parking late partiers that didn't make me grumpy, I would want to live missionally to them. And all of those things, they do pop up, but I just want to say, what if, when we think about a missional life, what if it doesn't start with reading a bunch of books so that you can answer all of the questions that your weird uncle on Facebook has about Christianity? What if it didn't start with you finding time that you don't already have? But what if a missional life, as Chad said, started where you already are? In the season of life you're in, as a young mom, as an empty nester, as a single person, what if a missional life was found in the season of life you're already in, the job you already have, with the neighbors that you already have, or the roommates that you live with? A missional life can be found there, so let's start there. I want to offer us three practices that help us live a more open life to everyone we meet. These aren't three hacks to, like, maximize your evangelism. Some of you really do have the spiritual gift of evangelism. And praise God for that. Many of us need to be praying for that. But these are not just, hey, three quick hacks to figure out how to move conversations a step deeper, to trap people in, like, a biblical conversation. Like, if that's your cup of tea, man, you sound awesome at parties. But these are three practices that we can cultivate over time. So first, a missional life starts by living honestly. When we think about living a missional life, when we think about practices of proclaiming the good news of Jesus, all of it can get reduced down to this is about living honestly. On June 24th, 2025, I joined one of my close friends, who's one of my three, and this is a friend that does not follow Jesus, in downtown Oklahoma City. It was maybe the most important day in Oklahoma City's history. It was the championship parade for the Thunder. And we park in South Oklahoma City and make the, like, 17-mile walk, it felt like, over Scissortail Bridge. And as we get into Scissortail Park, the, like, mass of people are there. And I'm excited, and he's excited. He's got his camera out, and we start to pass both explicit T-shirt salesmen. If you guys were at this parade, you know the T-shirts they were selling about the thunder. And then the other people that were there across the street were the street preachers with voice amplifiers, cardboard signs, proclaiming a turn or burn message. And I'm like, both things are problematic. He's laughing at the T-shirts and is like, maybe I should buy one. And I'm like, I think I'd lose my job if I bought one. And then I am like, God, please shut his ears up as we pass these guys with voice amplifiers on like the best day in Oklahoma City ever that are trying to remind people that they're going to go to hell if they're wearing the shirt that these guys are selling. And for me, I'm just finding myself like, man, please, Lord, shut his ears. And I bring that up because as they're proclaiming this message, there's something that happened in my chest, and it happens all of the time I walk around with a non-Christian friend and some sort of cringy church sign or some sort of attribute of a street evangelist comes up that just kind of ties me up in knots. And if I'm not careful, it's going to lead me to believe that you either do that form of evangelism or you do nothing at all. Somehow we've made evangelism into like doing your best to try to tell, like share a timeshare in Branson for God. We've made it into like, hey, I know that you're busy, but if you have 5 seconds, I'd love to talk to you. And if I do it right, I can actually lock you and your kids in for life. And we have to actually like wrestle with the fact that like, man, that is not what a missional life is. And for many of us, we've reduced down the types of evangelism we will never do. And what it ends up making us into is just really spiritually polite people that keep certain conversations about Jesus off of the table. But what if a missional life just started with living more honestly? Because I am aware that no one in our city likes to be evangelized to. None of us enjoy like someone knocking on our door saying like, hey, I've got something to tell you or sell you. None of us enjoy that, yet everyone in our world and in our culture is proclaiming some form of good news. So think about it, whether it's like someone in Bass Pro trying to sell you a timeshare in Branson, or it's a friend trying to like get you to buy essential oils, or a mom saying, hey, if you just took the certain types of dye out of your kid's diet, your kid will behave. Like we're all going to proclaim some form of good news. And for followers of Jesus, we are just those who have decided to tell the truth. Hey, there's good news one place, and its primary place is in the New Testament and in the story of God. For followers of Jesus, we are those who preach the good news of Jesus. We're trying to be honest and preach that good news. And for most of us, it's not going to lead us to a street corner, but it will lead us to live more honestly in every relationship we have, the places we find ourselves in, and everywhere that we go. Because what happened in my chest was a temptation at that parade to try to save my friend from emotional discomfort. Man, like, I wish they would be more tactful. Like, they're saying about 70% truth and 30% just weird cultural stuff. But it was really just because I didn't like this style of evangelism. And that same temptation will wrap you and I up in knots and lead us to live dishonest lives with our families or our friends, our coworkers, or our neighbors. And this is the same temptation that will lead you to keep conversations about spirituality off the table with certain people in your life. So maybe it's during certain meetings at work or around certain people in the office. You're just like, man, I know for sure not to bring up the things of Jesus. I won't even ask about their spirituality or what they did on the weekend because I don't want to know. I don't want to have that conversation. Or for some of us, it's with our adult kids who have walked away from faith. Man, I just want them to come home from Christmas. I don't want to have that conversation with them. Or maybe it's your neighbor who you've like tried to build trust and equity, and you're like, it's just not time yet. I've not like had them over for dinner. I've not done the thing Chad said, so I can't share anything with them. But over time, this temptation begins to form us to compartmentalize and segregate our life out in places that we can be honest and places that we choose to just quite honestly be dishonest in. Well, I can't do that there because, man, that's going to lead to other things conversations I need to have. So go with me here. If you investigate your heart, we'll start to see that often the reality of our spiritual politeness has more to do with loving ourselves than it does loving others. It has more to do with our own comfort and our desire to like stay emotionally safe than it does loving our neighbors and desiring their ultimate comfort that's found in Christ. So friends, living honestly is not about trying to convince your coworkers of the Bible's truth claims over lunch in the office. If you've done that, kudos, but that's often not what we're talking about when we think about living a missional life. It's more about just being completely honest about the work that God has done in your life, what he's teaching you, the ways you found truth and anchoring in his word and his ways. So before we move on, where are you currently living dishonestly, and what does reintegrating into an honest life look like for you? What's a relationship or an environment that you're just tempted, man, I want to live an honest life, but God, I need your help. What relationship, what environment can you step into a more honest life into? And second, a missional life leads to rhythms of hospitality. Hopefully this one is quick, but Chad just referenced this. But I want to ask you this question. What would you say to someone in your group who asked, like, hey, what is Frontline's way of doing mission in the city? What's our strategy to proclaim the good news or to demonstrate the kingdom of, like, what does Frontline like do for that? What would you say? Because the reality is we don't have a program. We don't have an event once a year. We don't have like a special forces Christian missions team that leaves the building and goes and makes converts. But rather our strategy for mission is your life and my life. Our strategy for evangelism is the men and women that make up all of our congregations across the metro. Our strategy of evangelism is the 6 days that we scatter between Sundays, which leads to a good question. If that's our strategy, what was Jesus' strategy? What methods did Jesus have to seek and save the lost? Chad just talked about this, but the primary method that Jesus had to engage those far from God with the good news was Jesus deciding to eat a meal with them, even going so far to invite himself over to people's homes. He referenced this Robert Karras quote where it says in Luke's gospel, Jesus is either going to a meal, he's at a meal, or he's coming from a meal. And this explains that the reputation that he got from the Pharisees who said, look at him, a glutton, a drunkard, a friend of tax collectors and sinners. Jesus just could not stay away from a good meal or good drinks with friends. And when Jesus wasn't eating a meal, he was teaching about meals. Luke 14, Jesus tells a parable of a great banquet. Luke 15, Jesus tells the parable of the prodigal son that ends with a lavish feast. And then in Luke 22, Jesus says, I'm assigning to you as my father assigned to me a kingdom. Why? That you may eat and drink at my table in my kingdom. And this is helpful because if you think back to Genesis 3 and a meal of rebellion and treason against God that Adam and Eve partook in, it wasn't just a breaking of a moral speed limit, but it was a meal of treason. And so Jesus shows up on the scene. He starts to eat and drink with those who have been estranged from God. And when Jesus shows up, we see his desire to sit down with those far from God and share a meal. A meal of not rebellion, but grace, forgiveness, and redemption. Jesus, through rhythms of hospitality, would engage those far from God and plead them to come home. And as followers of Jesus who have been invited into his mission, his method should inform our methods. One author, Tim Chester, said this in his book, A Meal with Jesus. He says, we often make community and mission sound like specialized activities that belong to experts. And some people even have a vested interest in doing this because it makes them feel extraordinary. Or we focus on dynamic personalities who can hold an audience, lead a movement, and some push mission beyond the scope of ordinary Christians. But the Son of Man came eating and drinking. It's not complicated. True, it's not always easy. It involves people invading your space or going to places where you don't feel comfortable, but it is not complicated. So when we're talking about a life of mission, we're not talking about something that's really complex. It's not easy, but it isn't complicated. We're talking about doing something that you already do and people that you love that are far from God already do. You eat meals, they eat meals, And if you offer to cook it or pay for it, most people will show up. So I think it's helpful before we move on just to remember that doing things like this and the cultural moment that even Chad brought up that article about is really odd to people. There's a community group leader at Frontline South that was telling me a story of inviting one of their neighbors over for dinner. He was a single guy in his late 40s and has kind of like hit a halt on his life, lost a job, bought this house with inheritance money. And he comes over for dinner and he was just really shocked that they sat down at a table for a meal. And he was even more like dumbfounded that their little kids sat down kind of for a meal. If you have toddlers, you know, like 5 o'clock is like, please be on your best behavior if there's a guest in our home. And they're going on telling him of like, he goes on to tell these leaders who are just talking to me about this dinner they had. And he started to say like, it's weird that you do this, but it also feels like otherworldly that you would invite me to come to your family's dinner. Like outside of like a holiday, he has no grid for a dinner with a family, and especially as a guy that lives in isolation. And I remember thinking that, and I kind of chuckled to myself, and the secret leaders were like, and that's what it was. It was otherworldly. We, as the people of God, were saying like, hey, this is a little signpost of where all of history is moving. There is another great meal that we're going to all be invited into. And for Christians, we're those who are not just pleading to come to this meal, but we're those who long for these people to also come to that great banquet that all of history is moving towards. And so these rhythms of hospitality are not complex, but they take a little bit of work. So how could you regularly eat and drink with those far from God? Are there rhythms or nights of the week that would regularly actually work for you? You don't need to try to like put square pegs in round holes and try to like have a missional dinner with a friend far from God on the same night that you have discipleship group. That's a conflict of interest. You're already booked. You have D group. But what other rhythms could you have to engage in this? So missional life is about living honestly. It's about practicing hospitality. And lastly, it's about a practice of long obedience in the same direction. That same friend of mine who I attended that Thunder Parade with, we met in 2020. And we would share coffee from now, from time every so often. And it wasn't until we started to actually work out together that we had regular rhythms of seeing each other and we built a friendship. And this helped me because like I struggled to work out unless I knew I was going to like leave someone stranded. So we, you know, committed to work out together. We both would show up. And through this 6-year friendship, I started to experience a lot of life with him. He went through a lot of transitions in his life over these last 6 years. And through each of those years, I tried to do what I'm offering. I tried to be present with him. I tried to like be honest with him about like my faith. He knows what I do for work. So I was being honest about like, hey, what relationship at all do you have with the church? Or what relationship at all do you have with Jesus? And I'm trying to like regularly apply the gospel to his like unique brokenness and story that he has. And 6 years go by, and you want to know what happened? Almost nothing. There's like little to no spiritual transformation in his life. And I'm like, at D group last October, I'm wrestling with the guys in my D group and saying, it's either me and my ability to articulate the gospel that stinks, or maybe it's God that stinks. And maybe my friend's just not like someone God wants to like save. And through the 6-year friendship, I have been wrestling with like, man, is it me? Is it God? Is it both of those things? And I bring that up because to cultivate a missional life means that you and I will eventually have stories of people that we love and care about that are still being written. And the good news about that is if I went around this room and I passed the mic, many of you have stories like that. Last night at our hub gathering, man, I'm looking at two really mature men and women in their late 50s, and God saved the husband into his 40s. The wife had been a Christian for a really long time. She'd prayed for her husband for like 2 decades. For many of us, God wrote really long stories with our lives. So eventually we're going to have to come face to face that this is more of a practice of long obedience in the same direction than it is to like expect transformation after a meal. You see, that same friend, as I started to write this talk back in December, because we were planning to have this in January, he started to show up to church. And it was the first time in 6 years, and it was the first week of Advent, that he decided to show up to church. And I'm not really sure what God's doing in his life. In the moment, I'm just like, man, there are certain people in our church I do not want to like greet him on Sundays. Because like we got plenty of eclectic people. I'm like, man, if they greet him, this whole plan is like completely sabotaged. But I'm just like asking the Lord, like, man, whatever you're doing, will you just have him keep coming back? Like, it's been 6 years of like my coffee meetings. Apparently they're not working. But he's been at church since the first week of Advent, and he's been there every Sunday since. And I don't know how his story is gonna end. And I can feel my temptation to try to want to be God for him and be like, I just want to see complete submission to Jesus and like you actually doing the thing. But it's not there yet. And that's helpful because it reminds us that we don't do the heavy lifting in a missional life. We don't do the saving. We're simply those who with unveiled faces behold who our God is and slowly over time are formed into his same image, which means we need to remember that our God is patient, our God is long-suffering. He deals with all of our weird quirks and like lack of committalness way more than we deal with our friends who are far from God's. A missional life is a practice of long obedience in the same direction as we try to cultivate living an honest life and rhythms of hospitality. So where do we go from here? I wanted to sum up this talk with three invitations that I think aim our lives at this. First one is just to do this. Identify and pray for your three. I'm starting easy here because the good news is if you're in a discipleship group that's following the discipleship group guide, you do this every time you meet. Which brings up another point. If you're not doing this for the love of God and the love of the lost, start. Like, I don't accidentally pray for my lost friends. Like, I have enough chaos with toddlers in my life and work and my own family. I'm praying about a whole host of things. I don't always remember, like, oh, yeah, so-and-so. Let me pray for, like, but these rhythms that we can actually put into our calendar inside of our discipleship groups are a big deal. So this identify and pray for your three is important. Because for all of us, our three will change and fluctuate. I have never had like three people. I have had like two. Because these questions are helpful to identify the three. Are you actually in close proximity with this person to whom you feel called? If it's your second uncle that lives in Maine, probably not. That doesn't mean you shouldn't like have a heart for them and shouldn't pray for them and like call them. But just be easy on yourself. Like if you're not in close proximity with these people, find a new person. Shia LaBeouf has this thing about your dreams, like chase your dreams unless your dreams suck, then get new dreams. If your three do not like live close to you, get a new three. Ask yourself this, am I spending regular time with them? And if not, why? Does your life not afford for it? Are there other things that you need to say no to or yes to? If you're working out 6 days a week, could you work out five? And grab coffee with them on one of those days? Are you too busy to develop meaningful relationships with them? So that's the first one, identify and pray for your three. The second one is just to move towards people. Moving towards people simply means following Jesus' posture of seeking others out, sharing meals, scheduling coffee, scheduling time to enjoy a hobby together, do things together with them. I find, and I think most of the secret leaders I talk to, if you're doing this, you are the one that always initiates and your friends far from God are like terrible at this. For some reason, like you're the ones like, I'm always like inviting them over and I'm always asking to do stuff. And like, that's not all the time, but often that it will feel like a one-sided relationship. And often in our own lives, God the Father is like regular doing the heavy lifting and initiating way more than we're reciprocating. And so that's okay, but move towards people. And the good news about moving towards people is it has more to do with asking good questions and growing as a present listener than it does having all of the answers. I've been guilty of this, but have you ever met somebody that has like an answer for everything? Well, if you just did this, like, a month into marriage, you're like, answers are not always helpful. Solutions aren't always needed. like, it's not about having all the answers, but asking good questions and growing as a present listener. Which leads to the last thing, move conversations a step deeper. Depending on your personality, meaningful conversations with others may come naturally or be a real challenge. But moving conversations a step deeper just starts with curiosity, and it leads us to accept and build on what we come to find out about that person. So let's take, for example, you have a neighbor that moves in. Hey, where'd you live before this? Oh, I lived in Norman, but then me and my wife got a divorce, and I moved up here. Oh, man, thanks for telling me that. If you don't mind me asking, you know, what led to the divorce? Well, we've been married for 25 years. We got the kids out of the house, and we had a lot of stuff that we didn't deal with. And for us, it just seemed like it was better to, you know, leave than actually do the hard work. That's like so many stories on my block. And now that I know that information, that actually allows me to have avenues to know how to love. Single people that have been divorced do a lot of holidays alone. Okay, do I have holidays that I celebrate? Yes, I can invite that man over to our house. Build on what you know. Hey, what made you move in by this house? Oh, my mom passed away and I got an inheritance and I could buy that house. Man, so sorry to hear that. Build on the information that they give you. And some people are like trying to tell you nothing. It's like, don't be weird and try to pry them open in like a driveway conversation, but ask questions, build on the information they give, take it a day at a time. We're going to move conversations a step deeper. We want to acknowledge information in the moment and build on that. So wrapping up, can you imagine a room of 60-ish, 80 people that started to do this? Across our congregations who've identified their three, are praying for them regularly, are trying to move towards them in rhythms of hospitality without the pressure to see transformation after one meal. What would God do? Who might be like worshiping with you on Sundays next year or in the next 6 years? It's helpful just to know that we don't do the heavy lifting. And friends, a missional life is not easy, but it isn't complicated. And the only person that we love by keeping conversations about Jesus off at the table is ourselves. It's the only person we're loving at that given moment. So let's practice the methods of Jesus. Let's keep our eyes fixed on him as we aim at long obedience in the same direction.